wants to force other nations to cede to its way of looking at the world, how to organize society, what rights citizens should have, what economic decisions that benefit China will be made. To achieve this, China employs millions of its citizens as hackers and internet monitors. In 2008, numerous published reports revealed that the government was paying tens of thousands of citizens 50 Chinese cents, the equivalent of 7 U.S. cents, each, to write an individual post promoting party policy. The payment amount gave rise to a new phrase, the 50-cent party, which was used by critics to describe blind fealty to CCP policy. By 2013, the numbers had swelled. Official Chinese media reported that the propaganda wing of the CCP had hired 2 million public opinion analysts. That number has doubtless climbed, aided by an estimated 10 million student volunteers who also engage in monitoring and disinformation work, both at home and on foreign websites. Meanwhile, the PLA's force of hackers launches assaults against U.S. companies, government agencies, political parties. Because of the diffuse nature of the internet, where a hacker in Beijing can route his computer to make it appear as if he is located in, say, Latvia, you might think it is difficult to ascertain where these attacks originate. But in many instances, the source is evident because of easily identifiable patterns to certain attacks. For example, American businesses have noticed that a cyber barrage will stop promptly at a set time every day, 11 p.m. in New York, which is lunchtime in China. An hour later, like clockwork, the Chinese cybernauts, having eaten, resume their attacks. And guess when the strikes stop for 12 to 14-hour periods? At 4 a.m. Eastern Time, the end of the workday at the PLA's digital sabotage bunkers. But the goals of the PLA are wide and varied. Stealing technical plans is great for specific purposes that, like building a sophisticated wind turbine or a patented chemical compound, can help destroy industry rivals, drive huge profits, and further strategic goals. But stealing data in bulk and accessing email can be even more valuable, unleashing a trove of information to be used broadly to achieve influence. At its most obvious level, accessing someone's emails or texts can be used for blackmail. We've seen this time and again in the West, gaining access to nude photos and private messages that expose financial wrongdoing or embarrassing sexual shenanigans are obvious tools to increase influence. There are, however, many more subtle and complex operations going on. When a hotel chain's customer database is compromised, when a company's employee directory is hacked, when credit reports are stolen, all these elements can be cross-indexed and mined to identify targets for influencing campaigns. Key corporate players can be identified. Their business trips can be tracked, exposing what companies might be working together or might be acquired, and any employees who are experiencing fiscal hardship. In this way, seemingly disparate data sets can provide actionable intelligence. Individuals and businesses can be targeted for strategic offensives to further CCP goals. This may sound drastic and complex, but it is part and parcel of the theories espoused in unrestricted warfare. The bonding agent of data, what the book makes clear is the most potent weapon in the modern world, is an explosive substance. In the hands of the PLA, digital assaults to access data are both destructive, entrapping and disrupting the West by setting off digital landmines, raids, and intelligence operations, and constructive. The results of these operations, covertly harvested data, allow China to accrue influence and power. I have already detailed a complex, high-stakes cyber sabotage operation in the chapter examining economic warfare. Here are two smaller examples of China's surveillance and undue digital influence. What is particularly chilling is how unsuspecting and completely innocent Americans wound up caught in influencing power plays without even realizing it. The disturbing case of Roy Jones. In January of 2018, a 49-year-old man named Roy Jones was working at the Customer Engagement Center of Marriott International in Omaha, Nebraska. One day while helping manage the company's Twitter feed, Jones saw that a Tibetan independence group had cited Marriott for listing Tibet as separate from China in a recent survey. Using Marriott's official rewards account, Jones liked the tweet. That one click, which Jones later claimed he didn't remember making, set off a sad and infuriating chain of events, one in which a major American corporation crumbled in the face of pressure from China. Although Twitter is banned in China, someone was clearly monitoring the feed maintained by the group promoting Tibetan independence and discovered two things. The Marriott chain had published a survey that might have implied Tibet was an independent country, and the Marriott Twitter feed liked the Tibet group's shout-out. These shocking events were flagged to the Shanghai Municipal Tourism Administration, which contacted Marriott representatives to complain about the survey and the tweet. The tourism group then ordered the company to publicly apologize and seriously deal with the people responsible, according to the Wall Street Journal. 3 days later, on January 14, 2018, Marriott fired Jones. "I was completely unaware of what was going on," Jones told the Journal. "We were never trained in any of the social graces when it came to dealing with China." And Marriott's corporate leadership evidently was never trained in defending its employees or standing up for free speech. Yes, the company has a fiduciary responsibility to stockholders, but it also has a responsibility to its employees and to the nation that has allowed Marriott to flourish. Roy Jones wasn't just the victim of a poor management decision. He was the victim of China's social media surveillance capabilities and economic influence. What happened to him could, as we'll see, conceivably one day happen to any American anywhere who does something Chinese authorities don't like. Football fan fishing. Thomas Everyman, not his real name, worked at a mid-sized tech company. Anyone looking at Everyman's LinkedIn page could learn his job title, the name of his employer, and the college he had attended. Anyone looking at his Facebook page could discover more personal details by looking at pages he had liked. He was, for example, an avid booster of his alma mater's football team. Not only had Everyman liked the team's page, he had also identified himself as a follower of a fan newsletter devoted to the team. This kind of personal information shouldn't seem particularly revealing or dangerous. But in the hands of hostile Chinese cyber forces, it was almost as good as having his sign-in name and password. One day, Everyman got to work and noticed that a newsletter about the team had arrived in his email inbox. His company email address, by the way, could be determined by a Google search for his employer's email format. He opened it up. It looked just like the newsletter he subscribed to, and he started reading. An item contained a hyperlinked bit of text linking to another article, but the item and the link were not what they seemed. They were part of a phishing attack. The item had been inserted by hackers. By clicking the item's accompanying link, Everyman unwittingly unleashed a malicious code that opened a path to the company's computer system and gave the Chinese hackers access to corporate plans, emails, technical specs. The company eventually realized that it had been compromised and hired an auditing firm to investigate. The firm traced the attack to Everyman's computer and pieced together how the employee had been targeted using publicly available information, a bit of cunning, and predatory technology. In the end, China was able to gain all the company's product designs and customer lists, as well as research and development. It then used this information to build a new company that would soon outcompete every man's company, which is now struggling to survive. As I said, these two stories involve average Americans just trying to live their lives, who somehow got caught in China's relentless quest to steal and intimidate, to influence and dominate. Without extreme vigilance and pushback by the U.S. government and U.S. companies, there is nothing to stop this from happening to anybody, including you. Redeployment. While the PLA has been organizing millions of Chinese to help on the digital battlefield, the U.S. Army has been besieged with contractors, lobbyists, and politicians urging it to conduct business as usual. As Representative Adam Smith, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, told reporters, "I've got the idea that the military-industrial complex has the incentive to try to tell you that you need to spend more money on defense, but that incentive does not necessarily translate into national security needs. It simply translates into money." Smith isn't wrong. And what's worse is how the lobbying and vying for money is inefficient, misleading, and divisive. It takes our collective eye off the most pressing issues. In August 2018, the U.S. Cyber Command, Cybercom, created in 2009, was made one of 10 unified command units within the Pentagon. Its mission is defined as planning, coordinating, integrating, synchronizing, and conducting activities to direct the operations and defense of specified Department of Defense information networks and prepare to, and when directed, conduct full-spectrum military cyberspace operations in order to enable actions in all domains, ensure U.S./allied freedom of action in cyberspace, and deny the same to our adversaries. That is a good start, but it is not enough. Given the modern-day realities and the size of the U.S. economy, which runs through digital platforms, cyber protection needs to be paramount. Cybercom should become the sixth branch of the U.S. Armed Forces, joining the Army, Air Force, Coast Guard, Marines, and Navy, with commensurate staffing and budget. It is that important. We need battalions of digital warriors to protect our businesses and infrastructure. The defense of our nation's power grid is just as vital as the defense of our borders. Actually, it may be more so. Without electricity, our society cannot function. Phones won't charge. Computers will crash. Life support machines will fail. Banks can't operate. Cash registers won't ring. Traffic lights won't work. People will perish. The cyber defense problem, like the problem of unchecked, irresponsible financing, like the problem of counterfeiting goods, like the problem of IP theft, has been kicked down the road by our leaders. Meanwhile, the attacks of modern warfare, cyber war, continue daily. What are we going to do about it? Social cyber assault. Although the phrase psychological warfare is fairly recent, the concept has been around forever. A broad definition would be any verbal acts made to weaken an opponent by making them feel less confident or instilling fear or division. The digital world has provided a massive, unsupervised platform for doing just that. The tools of pre-digital propaganda relied in general on two stages of deployment. First, ostensibly damaging information was put out into the world. Pamphlets rained down, radio shows aired, articles ran, rumors were floated. Second, that information was shared and repeated. But other than bombarding a targeted population with messages, there was no way to gauge how effectively the propaganda was replicating. Flyers dropped from airplanes could be collected and burned without being read, or they could be passed hand to hand like sacred texts. There was no way of ensuring the outcome. Now, in the unsupervised, unpoliced Wild West of the internet and social networks, psychological warfare has entered a new and potentially deadly realm. Social media is a tool to launch misinformation, division, and discord, to create false narratives, to destabilize, to interfere with the democratic process, to incite violence. It is a potent and subtle, almost undetectable form of poison. We've already seen what it can do to national events. Russia has been identified as the bad central actor in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, taking active measures during the campaign to sway independent and undecided voters in swing states against Hillary Clinton. While China has, as far as anyone knows, steered clear of meddling in the U.S. elections, there is no question that it is committed to conducting influencing operations. This quote from a paper issued by the Cyberspace Administration of China's Theoretical Studies Center Group makes a case for ongoing assaults on behalf of the CCP. Enhance the guidance of online public opinion, starting from the overall situation of the party and the state. Effectively propagandize achievements in reform and development and economic livelihood and propaganda, and provide policy interpretation on the economic situation. Alleviate doubts and boost confidence. Actively use new technologies and new applications to effectively guide the progression of online public opinion. Grasp the evolution and laws of the online public sentiment. Prevent hot issues from involving the economic and social livelihood of the people. And prevent mass incidents and public opinion from becoming online ideological patterns and issues. Play an important role in cyber comments and public opinion guidance, and make cyberspace cleaner. This is a government policy agency stating that the country's cyber forces should engage in active propaganda to shape public opinion. The document, dizzyingly entitled "Deepening the Implementation of General Secretary Xi Jinping's Strategic Thinking on Building China into a Cyber Superpower, Steadily Advancing Cybersecurity and Informatization Work," is even more explicit about the end goal of web and social media posting. Online positive publicity must become bigger and stronger so that the party's ideas always become the strongest voice in cyberspace. Kathleen M. Carley is an academic pioneer in the science of social cybersecurity. Hired initially as a sociology professor at Carnegie Mellon University, she now works at the Institute for Software Research within CMU's School of Computer Science, where she studies, in a broad sense, the links between computation, organization, and society. More narrowly, she is now a leading academic in the study of social cyber warfare, how bad actors can use social networks like Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, Instagram, and other platforms to manipulate users, promote and influence political agendas, conduct disinformation campaigns, and sow division and conflict. All social media platforms do two basic things, according to Carley and her researchers: provide users with access to particular individuals and access to particular content. The platforms develop algorithmic prioritization schemes to determine what users see and what they read, as well as which messages are recommended and which other users are recommended as people to follow. Groups or nations that want to conduct influence campaigns construct messages and activate users, including programmed bots, to exploit the prioritization logic of these services. By creating an army of bots that like and repost messages to create an echo chamber of manipulative posts, bad actors can inject misinformation and sow division into a society with an unparalleled ferocity and speed. It's a psychological warfare nightmare come true. Carly confirmed China's intense interest in keeping social networks under surveillance, noting that a media lab at Beijing's Tsinghua University receives the entire feed of data from China's popular Weibo platform. That is, the posts, images, videos, memes, and metadata of its 450 million plus users to analyze. This level of surveillance, Carly remarked, is one of the reasons people with surveillance concerns in China use virtual private networks, VPNs, which connect them to servers beyond what's known as the Great Firewall of China. VPNs allow users to send messages and make posts while avoiding the authorities' spying methods. It is also the reason that the CCP has banned Chinese websites from offering VPN apps and subscriptions. Obtaining a social media platform's entire data set is a dream come true for anyone engaged in cyber social warfare. First, it allows you to map the entire social structure of the platform. You can see who is connected to whom. Second, by reverse engineering the data, you can ascertain the prioritization rules driving a platform. You can learn the criteria for ranking people on the platform and how their posts and likes and comments are weighted, how reposting gains traction, how tagging can help expand the reach of a post. This information can then inform and optimize future cyber warfare operations for maximum impact. Or, as Carly puts it, they basically construct messages and fake groups so they can exploit the prioritization logic of these technologies. Having access to the content before the algorithms are applied to it is also something that concerns Carly. If it flows to you before it arrives where it was supposed to be going, you could actually put in deep fakes. You could alter the routing and affect the dissemination. You could edit the content of someone's post, too. Expanding global influence. While much of Carly's work has centered on tracking Russian campaigns to sow division and inflame tensions in the United States and Britain, in 2019, she began to examine how social media was being manipulated to influence national elections in the Philippines and Indonesia, two countries that are relatively close to China. In the Philippines, a nation that until recently had historically strong ties to the United States and that has the fourth largest population of English speakers in the world, President Rodrigo Duterte wrangled a pledge of $24 billion in investment, credit, and loans from China to upgrade his country's infrastructure. Since the agreement was announced in 2016, few upgrades have happened, and Duterte has come under fire for both overpromising and under-delivering, and for being duped by China. What we're seeing is an increase in the use of bots in the 2016 election, supporting Rodrigo Duterte and supporting the infrastructure development and these contracts, Carly says. I can't actually trace the IP address and say, definitely I can guarantee that's coming from China, but those are certainly activities in the Chinese interest. Similarly, social media research in Indonesia, where Twitter is hugely popular, has detected bot activity pushing the candidacy of incumbent President Jokowi Widodo and his cronies, Carly reports. As head of the world's most populous Muslim nation, Widodo has been conspicuously silent about China's persecution of its Muslim Uyghur population. But he has not been shy about meeting five times with President Xi or welcoming Chinese investment, which increased 300% from 2015 to 2016, according to This Week in Asia. His government, as a 2018 AP report put it, is reluctant to publicly criticize Beijing, fearing it could jeopardize potential Chinese investment. If China is conducting influencing operations in Indonesia, it appears to be much more subtle than the Russian efforts. It definitely seems like they're not trying to sell division too hard, says Carly. They're definitely trying to shore up a message that we're the good guys, you should like us, you should like our approach works better. That strategy hews close to techniques we'll discuss in an upcoming chapter about politics and diplomacy. The Chinese are very good at twisting the narrative to make you think they are genuinely acting in your own best interests and at convincing everybody to trust them. Of course, when it comes to trust issues, there may be no bigger game on the planet than 5G. Chapter 6. Modern Warfare 5.0. The 5G Future. In 2014, Deputy Secretary of Defense Robert Work was put in charge of the Defense Innovation Initiative. This project was heralded as the Third Offset Strategy, a phrase that drew on two of the most successful plans in U.S. military history. The first offset was Eisenhower's use of nuclear deterrence to counteract the Soviet Union's lead in conventional arms. The second offset, started by Defense Secretary Harold Brown and Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering William Perry in the Carter administration and continued by Reagan, called for investment in superior technologies, such as stealth aircraft, precision-guided missiles, and satellite spying. It is worth mentioning that these weapons were built using research and design breakthroughs of the 1960s and 1970s that were funded by the Pentagon. Back then, about 2% of America's GDP was spent on R&D. Today, we spend about 0.7%. Taken together, the first two offsets contributed to the fall of the Soviet Empire. The third offset, an ambitious department-wide effort to identify and invest in innovative ways to sustain and advance America's military dominance for the 21st century, according to Obama Administration Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, was going to leverage American technical innovation. It was necessary, Hagel added, because while we spent over a decade focused on grinding stability operations, countries like Russia and China have been heavily investing in military modernization programs to blunt our military's technological edge. When Robert Work started trying to implement the Defense Innovation Initiative, he and Hagel's replacement, Ash Carter, were in for a rude awakening. The Pentagon assumed that it would work with tech companies and share resources to build new cutting-edge weapons systems. But China had already thoroughly infiltrated the tech space with investments and scientists. We failed to realize that the Chinese were involved in all those commercial research partnerships. There were pacts with Google and partnerships with Apple. Chinese scientists often worked side by side with our scientists, even on research and development for the U.S. military. With these arrangements, any work performed on behalf of the U.S. military was likely going to be done by or shared with Chinese scientists. In other words, the introduction of the Internet inexorably linked economic security with our national security. We could no longer think about Silicon Valley's growth model as independent of our national security. In raising the alarm from inside government, I learned firsthand how firmly China's strategy was enabled by our own fixed notions of the separation of business and government, the separation of economic and national security. I also learned personally how hard the industry lobby would fight to defend its ability to maintain this dangerous status quo. More on that later. As for the startup market, where cutting-edge applications and innovation flourish, China remained focused on locking up early-stage tech deals, too. In 2015, Chinese investors participated in 271 deals, with total deal value of $11.5 billion, according to a report issued by the Defense Innovation Unit Experimental, which noted, This represented almost 16% of the value of all technology deals in that year, $72 billion. The Air Force's state-of-the-art stealth bomber, the F-35, a highly computerized machine built with systems accessible from the ground, is a victim of China's infiltration of U.S. technology. Some of the parts used to build F-35s are actually manufactured in China. In this instance, the supply chain becomes a huge vulnerability, and not just the secrets the manufacturers are given access to are at risk. The plane itself is. Army intelligence has concluded that the Chinese stole all the plans for the F-35. Now you have to wonder about sabotaged parts that might destroy the machine, or worse, the idea that components contain backdoor access to the plane's operating system. In this scenario, it is conceivable that the plane could be taken down or hacked. We might lose command and control of our own asset. So, the United States has the most versatile and agile stealth flying machine in the world, and we can't trust it because we don't have the secure digital pipes we need to ensure that the correct data flows in safely, dependably, without exposure to hacking. Which brings me to the matter of 5G, the groundbreaking fifth-generation modern communications paradigm. The 5G platform is not like 2G or 3G or even 4G. Not even close. It is not just a mobile phone network built to connect phone calls, email, and text messages. Think of it as the next generation of the Internet, built for machines. It is, not to put too fine a point on it, 100 times faster than 4G. That means there will be almost no latency, no delay, between sending and receiving data on 5G. So 5G is a much faster, more direct, more precise platform that allows nearly instantaneous communication between people, between machines, and between people and machines. That speed and precision mean 5G will transform our society in ways that are hard to fathom. It is a strategist's job, however, to look toward the future and explore possible outcomes. It is clear that technological advances will accelerate well beyond the current pace, as data will be able to flow from apps and sensors, feeding machine learning and artificial intelligence engines. Accentuating the positive, it is easy to imagine 5G improving many facets of modern life. Surgeries might be able to be performed remotely by doctors or even by machines. And machines, cars in need of brake pads, home furnaces in need of cleaning, air conditioners in need of filters, lamps in need of light bulbs, will be able to self-regulate and notify owners or managers when they need servicing. Furthermore, dangerous jobs, such as unsafe mining operations, deep-sea salvage, or the sterilization of clinics during an Ebola outbreak, may be done using remote robots. But for all the promise of this new, completely wireless world, and yes, even the once vital transcontinental fiber optic lines lying on the ocean floor may be rendered obsolete by the power of 5G, the new network will bring new vulnerabilities, new security worries, and new national concerns. Defending against these security threats should fall, at least in part, to the military. But, ironically, the military needs to be defended too. If the communications system used by our national defenses is penetrated, our nation's safety will be compromised. When I joined the National Security Council in May 2017, I had two goals in mind. Educate the other members of the NSC on China's not-so-covert campaign for global dominance, and ensure the security of the 5G network, not only within U.S. borders, but for our allies as well. Given decades of Chinese digital infiltration and IP theft, there was little doubt that the CCP would put a premium on controlling 5G networks. China's biggest telecom companies, Huawei and ZTE, began aggressively offering to build 5G networks for other nations. And that set off alarm bells in my head. If a Chinese telecom builds and controls a nation's 5G network, there will be no checks and balances to keep the Chinese company from stealing and mining all the data on that network. All the academic papers and research, all engineering and business plans, all the photos, emails, and text messages, everything will be fair game to a country that doesn't believe in fair games. Furthermore, controlling another nation's network will allow the CCP to weaponize the technology that is managed by the network. What does that mean? Think of a hostile force taking over a self-driving car or bus and directing it to crash into a crowded sidewalk. Think of a flock of drones moving into the flight path of an airplane. Think of every digitally controlled furnace shutting down during a sub-zero cold spell. The blend of technologies and spectrums behind 5G will allow for about 3 million connected devices per square mile. This is an exponential upgrade from 4G, which enables about 10,000 connections per square mile. That means that in a stadium hosting an NFL football game, every smartphone-owning fan in attendance will have a network connection, but so will any drones, sensors, or robots in or near the stadium, including the cars in the parking lot. The capacity for communication offered by 5G is stunning. It is much better to think of 5G as a network built for machines, since most of the network traffic will eventually be machine to machine. This will allow for massive data production, which will feed machine learning and artificial intelligence algorithms, which in turn will continue improving the technology in a giant information feedback loop. The societal implications of 5G on how we live and how we work are truly mind-boggling. And so is the capacity to abuse that power. Let's be totally clear. Anything connected to an unsecured 5G network will be a potential weapon that can be used to gain geopolitical influence and control. If China were to control a 5G network, it would be able to weaponize the technology within entire cities or entire countries served by that network and hold that city or state at its mercy. The NSC is run by the National Security Advisor, who has an office in the West Wing of the White House. Most of his staff, the council, operates out of the old executive office, now known as the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, just west of the White House. The council, as you'd imagine, is filled with experts. Some are Middle East experts, some are Russia experts, some are Europe experts. Some are nuclear weapons experts. Naturally, every expert thinks his area of focus is of paramount importance, myself included. But if the NSC is concerned with clear and present danger, which is part of its mandate, I knew to my core that the biggest threat to national security wasn't ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and radical Islam, or Vladimir Putin. It was and is China. And nothing would be more damaging than the CCP's potential global dominance of 5G networks. I intended to make this clear to the entire NSC. Unfortunately, because of internal politics, I didn't have the clout to push my understanding of China's strategy to the forefront of the NSC. So I crafted a way to build awareness of China's threat to security indirectly. I organized a series of open forums I called Winning Without War and invited the entire NSC to attend. I booked speakers to discuss economic warfare, political warfare, information warfare, and legal warfare. Different ways that you can defeat an opponent without actually firing a shot. The forums each consisted of a 45-minute presentation, a 20-minute Q&A, and then a 45-minute free-for-all discussion. For the first meeting, I asked James Mulvenin, a longtime China hand and co-author of 2013's Chinese Industrial Espionage, to talk. The effect was electric, total engagement. Many of the Trump administration who were interested in China policy were there. By the end of the meeting, things got really heated. At one point, a China watcher basically called a military policy expert a panda hugger and all hell broke loose. This was not business as usual at the NSC. To keep the peace, I got up and gave the last word. I thanked everyone for attending and said I had two observations. The first thing that we need to do is realize that the enemy is not in this room. It's 6,000 miles away. And the second thing is that the truth is we've all been alcoholics, essentially getting drunk on China. What are we going to do about it? The talks were well attended and extremely influential. I believe they led to an invitation to contribute to the 2018 National Security Strategy and help lay out our China policy and our 5G policy. I began drafting a memo about the future of 5G in the United States. In it, I stated that the creation of the network was a national security issue, as opposed to a business or technology issue. The paper asserted that protecting the security of our 5G network was critical to stopping Chinese influence and hostile actions. And because that was critical to maintaining our levels of security and freedom, the effort should be led by the U.S. government. The document outlined a plan to transition to a wholesale model for wireless communications. The idea was that the United States would share the military spectrum with a private company that would construct and maintain a secure 5G network and then lease out bandwidth to retail providers. By providing a secure option in which communications would be encrypted and protected, and allowing telecoms to procure and provide access to the network, we would ensure the integrity of our information and communications infrastructure and begin to break China's telecommunications market dominance. In my proposal, I compared a government build-out of 5G to Eisenhower's National Highway Plan, a giant infrastructure plan that sought to ensure the swift movement of military troops, hardware, and ancillary support through the country. Yes, it opened up the nation and jump-started the long-distance trucking industry, but the multi-billion dollar highway project was rooted in infrastructure and security. The 5G platform is no different. It is about building a highway too, an information highway. Although my analogy was rooted in history, the proposal was greeted as a radical idea in many quarters. Telecommunications in America has been owned and operated by the private sector for more than 100 years. The multi-billion dollar industry regarded the idea of government involvement, other than the breakup of AT&T's monopoly in the 1970s, as antithetical to free trade and therefore inconceivable. The idea that the government would be overstepping its bounds, however, flies in the face of precedent and reality. The government of the United States controls or regulates many markets of national importance. Airlines are subject to the rules and requirements of the Federal Aviation Administration, which oversees the skies of America. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission licenses and inspects reactors. The Food and Drug Administration dictates which drugs can and can't be sold. The federal government even controls the price of milk. Airlines, nuclear power, drugs, and food. Those are four vital industries with government regulation that I was able to name off the top of my head. I'm sure there are plenty of others. So the argument that the government would be over-regulating by managing or overseeing 5G to ensure national security and safety is entirely disingenuous. That's precisely what a government should do. And I say that as someone with libertarian leanings. My proposal was leaked to the press. I have no idea who was behind the disclosure, but it set off a firestorm of criticism. Sources have told me that representatives of a large American telecom put pressure on the administration to get rid of me. Apparently, those sources were correct. That same week, I received word that my detail was ended. That was the system's way of saying I was being removed, in effect, fired from my position at the NSC. My bid to awaken the NSC and to ensure that America can operate safely and securely in the future was over. On one level, I was okay with leaving the NSC. I had succeeded in getting a 5G declaration placed in the 2018 National Security Strategy document signed by President Trump. We will improve America's digital infrastructure by deploying a secure 5G internet capability nationwide. I also felt that I had succeeded in awakening the NSC to China's stealth war. My goal was to get people to understand the problem because that is the first step toward formulating good policy. But on another level, nobody likes being forced out of a job. That was frustrating. The scariest, most disheartening thing of all, however, was the thought, the reality, actually, that after more than 20 years serving my country, I was bounced, in part, so that corporations could sacrifice long-term national security for quick and easy short-term profits. This has become the American way. It has to change. Now. Chapter 7. Politics and Diplomacy. War is a mere continuation of policy by other means. Karl von Clausewitz, a German military theorist, wrote those words two centuries ago. He was referring to public policy, another name for politics. Military scholars then generally interpret this statement as saying that politics and war are synonymous. And that means politics can be viewed as a continuation of war by other means. This makes perfect sense where China is concerned. What Clausewitz is saying, that war is a political act or a political decision used to drive an outcome in the winner's favor, can be applied to the CCP's strategy. The CCP uses political and diplomatic engagement and deception to gain control and expand China's spheres of influence without going to war. This echoes the brilliant central idea of both Sun Tzu's The Art of War and Unrestricted Warfare, to get what you want without going into battle. The Chinese have absorbed this lesson. They understand the risks and damage of war. For thousands of years, they have been farmers, not fighters. They built the Great Wall to try to eliminate war. So their solution is to pick up on Clausewitz's theory and sort of turn it on its head. China says, "War? We are not going to play that game." Instead, China views politics and diplomacy as the battlefield, although it takes pains not to seem like the aggressor. The CCP uses guile, cunning, bribery, and bargaining to achieve desired outcomes. Or, to put it in real-world terms, its entire strategy is built around political influence, information, and buying people off. The heart of political and diplomatic warfare, influencing, is a two-step process. First, it requires knowing who pulls the levers, that is, who has the clout to make things happen. Second, it requires getting those people to do your dirty work by convincing them that they are serving their own best interests. In other words, Chinese diplomacy seeks to manipulate targets so they don't realize they are doing the CCP's dirty work. To do this, China convinces other countries that it is a good neighbor or partner and is genuinely trying to help their partners help themselves. There is little doubt that this ploy drives the vast majority of deals as China unfurls its projected $1.3 trillion Belt and Road infrastructure plan for developing nations. By building a global network of connected railroads, highways, and ports throughout two-thirds of the world, China can talk a great game about helping countries participate in the worldwide economy. But it also puts the CCP in a position to control that economy and exploit all the data that is generated as people and goods move around the world. No conflict, no confrontation, win-win cooperation is the CCP's sly slogan. The same "trust us and let us help you" idea is used again and again as China strikes deals all over the globe and as it offers to build deep ports, as it has in Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Greece, and other nations. It's easy to see how a developing nation can be lured by what might seem like favorable terms and generous revenue projections, all pitched at strengthening its economy. It's easy to imagine that nation's leaders saying, "This is good for our," while Chinese diplomats nod in agreement. What is rarely discussed is how the leaders entering these agreements may also benefit from kickbacks, sweetheart side deals, and other enticements. If you can convince someone that the things that they're doing are in their own best interest, then that's the easiest way to get them to act. Just ask any con man. He'll tell you the same thing. If you can align your rival's motives politely, without any coercion, by subtle influence and clever words, by offering access to money, or by wielding false information that masks onerous terms, you are winning the war. The word diplomacy has evolved. Today, it conjures up images of careful, polite negotiation, but it hasn't always been viewed that way. Diplomacy is conducted, of course, by diplomats, and that brings up another worthy centuries-old quote. An ambassador is an honest man sent to lie abroad for the good of his country. This line was uttered by a man who personified the dignified image of diplomacy. Sir Henry Wotton was a poet and art connoisseur who served as England's ambassador to Venice in the early 17th century. China uses both forms of diplomacy. Ideally, it relishes operating behind the scenes when it comes to negotiation. While transparency is a hallmark of good governance in the West, discussing policy in public, issuing statements to the media, is something Chinese diplomats actively discourage. When I began working as a military attaché in Beijing, I was told by the Chinese that making policy issues public was tantamount to offending the feelings of 1.4 billion Chinese people. That, of course, is absurd. How is publicly discussing any international issue an offense? And yet, when I arrived at the Joint Chiefs of Staff, this attitude of not publicly calling China out on issues had permeated the U.S. federal government. I don't know if this policy was in place during the Clinton or Bush administrations, although I suspect that it was, given their inaction on China. But the instructions from the Obama administration were loud and clear. We are not going to do anything in public to antagonize China, as the relationship is too significant financially. The narrative was that the two most powerful countries in the world had to cooperate and get along to solve great challenges, like North Korea and climate change. The stance was built on the absurd idea that China wants to fix either of these issues. It doesn't. North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, lives and breathes by the will of the CCP, which loves having him act like a totalitarian madman and divert attention away from the Beijing government's oppressive actions. This is no exaggeration. An estimated 50,000 North Koreans are working daily in Chinese factories, basically funding an underground economy in North Korea. And when it comes to Kim building intercontinental ballistic missiles, who, logically, would have supplied his broke and embargoed nation with those plans? As for the environment and climate change, China's overfishing is destroying fisheries across the globe. When its trawlers are caught red-handed in foreign waters, it issues denials or announces increased vigilance, but the next day, Chinese ships are out raiding the ocean again. Meanwhile, China remains the world's worst polluter, spewing more carbon into the air than any other nation on Earth. But even in this realm, it sidesteps the rules. One brilliant thing China has done, tactically speaking, is build coal-fired electricity plants in neighboring countries, including Russia, then pipe the energy across the border. So China can claim it is reducing the amount of carbon it generates by outsourcing the problem across the border, while it remains responsible for poisoning the air as much, if not more, than ever. The carbon maneuver underscores how China has mastered the other form of diplomacy, spin. Chinese diplomats focus on good optics, portraying their positions as helpful, issuing sound bites that ooze with goodwill, and hosting elaborate conferences and junkets designed to showcase their generosity and do-good visions. But these carefully constructed exchanges are often distractions, misdirections, or total lies designed to disarm suspicion and sway popular opinion. While the Russians practice atomization, breaking down societies into rival groups, the Chinese practice obfuscation, clouding and cloaking behaviors. It's the opposite of transparency. Policy moves are conducted in secret, motives hidden, until deals are signed, sealed, and delivered. These two philosophies of influence, one loud, one quiet, actually work in tandem. Russia's activity serves as a distraction, while China waltzes out the back door with the loot. Finally, in the event that diplomacy fails and the friendly overtures of contract offers, trade terms, payouts, and infrastructure building deals fall through, the old methods, such as intimidation, bullying, bribery, misinformation, and extortion, can get the job done. Such tactics have more to do with thuggery than diplomacy, but the ends, increasing the CCP's influence over not just foreign governments and corporations, but also media outlets, religious groups, academics, civil rights groups, and, at a frighteningly granular level, individual citizens, justify the means. Sadly, none of these bullying practices should surprise anyone. These diplomats and influence peddlers represent a country that routinely ignores international trade laws, property laws, environmental laws, drug laws, and pretty much any other law that stands in its way. The first rule of unrestricted warfare, said Colonel Chao Liang, co-author of the book on the subject explaining the strategy he envisioned, is that there are no rules, with nothing forbidden. Welcome to Chinese diplomacy. Influencing influencers. China pushes two levers to quietly achieve diplomatic influence, access to Chinese markets and access to money. In the United States, the lure of access to Chinese markets has been cast year after year. As we've discussed, it's been pretty clear that China has used this as a carrot on a stick to drive Wall Street and the investment community into a fever dream of future earnings. These visions are fantasies as long as China insists that earnings must remain in China. When China does disburse huge sums of money in America, it is to gain information, technology, or influence. To wield those two weapons effectively, China's diplomatic wing has distilled its mission into two tasks, identifying people of influence and then swaying them. Tellingly, these guidelines are not that different from the rules driving many intelligence and counterintelligence operations to develop spies. For the CCP, ideal targets are people with political clout who either make decisions or advise people who make decisions. At the highest levels, CCP diplomats woo the presidents, prime ministers, and cabinet leaders of foreign governments. In the United States, Chinese operatives, businessmen, journalists, students, and military officers, as well as members of the Chinese embassy in Washington, D.C., or its mission in New York, zoom in on senators, members of Congress, and military officers for influence operations. But to reach those targets, they may also reach out to a senator's wife, or the employer of a senator's wife, or, as in the case of Joe Biden, a vice president's son. Engagement is a crucial requirement for influencing operations. It may start with a meeting invitation, an offer to share a meal or attend a conference, or an offer to launch a joint venture. From there, relationships build and deals are struck. Sometimes these influencing operations can be blatantly obvious, such as the deal to back Hunter Biden's investment fund with $1 billion. There are plenty of targets for China influencers. For instance, there are 100 senators and 435 members of the House of Representatives, and every single one of them, for various reasons, is interested in money and access to foreign markets. A D.C. dancer. On November 8, 2017, Montana Senator Steve Daines issued a press release proudly announcing that he had secured a deal between the Montana Stock Growers Association and JD.com, one of China's largest retailers, which had agreed to purchase a minimum of $200 million in Montana-sourced beef over the next several years. The deal marked an end to China's ban on buying meat from America.